This week's podcast is brought to you by West Baton Rouge. Come explore West Baton Rouge this spring and join in for the annual Kite Festival, April 27th through 28th. Visit westbatonrouge.net for more information.
You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Laborde, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's a Louisiana song. My favorite melody is a Louisiana song, hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
We'll be talking about the news today. But the news may be a little bit of a different perspective on that. We're going to look at a four-decade period from 1984 to now. And why those four decades is because we're also looking at a program that covers the news and that is informed sources, which has 40th anniversary this year on WYS Channel 12. The two people you're going to hear in the conversation are hardly impartial observers. With me is Marcia Cavanaugh, who is the founder of the show and who is the moderator. And the other person is me, who is there from pretty much near the beginning and have been involved with it. And so we've seen it grow and develop, and I'm personally very proud in it. I could tell you more, see, and I'm sure you get the same thing. We get a lot of reaction on the street.
We get a lot of reaction. We really do. So many people come up to me, and usually the grocery store, because that's my big outing these days of my life. But wherever, folks will come up and just say, I just want to let you know, we watch every Friday night. Yeah. It's so important to us. We really, really enjoy it. And that just warms my heart to hear that.
Yeah. You know? And so it's more popular than people realize or know. And I'm proud of that because I think it plays a role. So anyway, I thought we were going to do, well, first, I want to talk about some of the news stories during that period. But before we started, that you were raising questions or at least things we should talk about putting the show together, mm-hmm. How's it done? I wish I could tell you it's a huge operation, okay? But it's really not, okay?
It's not. You know, just to kind of, if we would go back to the origins of it.
Okay.
But I was at WYS. I'd been a staffer, and then I went into contract work because I was raising a family. And I just finished a documentary on the history of New Orleans called Survival and Celebration. When the director of broadcasting at that time, Julius Kane, came to me, he said, hey, you know, we're thinking of doing a show sort of like City Desk. Now, City Desk was a Times-Picayune reporter roundtable that WYS aired. They wanted, they being Julius Kane and also Mike Labonia was the general manager at that time, wanted to resurrect that show. So he said, would you be interested in putting together? I said, absolutely. I would definitely be interested in doing that. So we decided the format would be, once again, a reporter roundtable. I was a little concerned that I'd be able to fill a half hour with reporters talking about stories. No need for concern about that. But our first year, though, we brought in also what we called a newsmaker segment. And Elizabeth Curran, who I had worked with at WDSU, dear friend to this day, she did our first newsmaker segments. And so that was the format of the show in the very beginning. And in terms of putting it together, I quickly learned it's easier said than done because, you know, you have to focus on, okay, what is the story that we want to talk about and who is covered and who's going to have knowledge of it. They're not always available. And so it really does take a lot of hustle each week to put together that panel. And I know that's something that you deal with and you have dealt with now for many years.
Yeah, but we've got the show will pattern after the City Desk. Those reports reported from the state's item. There were two newspapers, the Picayune and the Item. Eventually, the Picayune acquired the Item, mm-hmm. and Charlie Ferguson was the editor of the Item. So for him, it was easy. I mean, it was just like the reporters in his newsroom, you know, you will do the show. And people like Alan Katz was, I think, among the among
Walter
the
first Isaacson. Story. Walter
yeah.
Isaacson, also.
And then after a while, there was that split, and then essentially when it became informed sources, we did it ourselves. In fact, it went in the opposite direction because in the early days, the Picayune management didn't want to participate.
No, they didn't. They said no.
And that was an issue. And I guess they thought, well, too much competition for him or something. Okay.
Well, I talked to Charlie Ferguson about it, and I recall that he really preferred that they did not appear because he felt that he was the editor of his reporters and nobody else. Mm. So that's why they didn't come on for years, really, and not until after Katrina.
It was a long time. Mm-hmm. And then it was starting to loosen a little bit. Stars like Mark Schlefstein that usually allow, but they just wanted to be sure that they weren't talking about something that they were writing about, which they wouldn't have done anyway. And so it kind of went along that way. And so we relied mostly on television reporters, mm-hmm. and I was at Gambit, and we had some Gambit people and radio people. But we didn't have any people from the Picayune. But once we got them in, I think a big help. Just as today, having the Advocate staff.
Yeah, today we have so many folks on, you know, from the Advocate, and then from other news agencies too. Of course, television and radio, and you know, people also ask me. I'm going to assume they ask you too. I mean, how do you pick the stories? How do you pick, you know, the reporters? Well, you basically are the reporter, the producer, so you decide how the discussion is going to go and what areas. But generally, you know, we look at the big stories of the day or of not necessarily only that week, but sort of ongoing stories. And then you try to get the very beginnings of the show, the reporters who covered those stories, those reporters who would really have knowledge of it. And so that's how the show comes together each week. Yeah. Sometimes easier than others because the reporters are reporters. They're covering stories, and they're not always available when we want them to be.
We've always had a strong lean towards politics. We've all been good through politics. We've also really been interested in media and media as a story. And I think business that we're doing, mm-hmm. doing a lot. There are some areas I could tell you for a long while I was looking for someone who was like a regular reporter covering homeless because that's such an issue out there. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any one person doing it. Now there is someone, mm-hmm. Sophia Kasnikoff.
Sophie Kasnikoff, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who's doing that. And so I'm looking for that. I have a special feeling for daily newspaper reporters because, and this isn't putting down TV reporters, but the difference is daily newspaper reporters have a beat, right? I mean, they pretty much, they got this one area of specialization that they go to and they cover. And so they tend to develop really kind of an expertise, whereas TV people cover a lot of different things. And so they, and some are good reporters, and some of the best investigative reporting is being done, like with, you know, like Lee Zurich is doing it, you know. So I think we have a good well out there to draw from.
We definitely do. And also from the Baton Rouge area, Jeremy Alford with La Politics Weekly. He's been on the show a lot over the years, really just a depth of knowledge of what's going on in Baton Rouge. So, you know, informed sources, while it's focused certainly in the beginning, primarily Orleans, but it's also really been a metro focus, and maybe that's even grown a little bit more in the post-Katrina days because we've seen so much growth in St. Tammany Parish. And a lot of news coming out of St. Tammany Parish now, too. And, of course, Jefferson Parish.
Yeah. I think our first star, at least in my mind, was John McGinnis, who was a native of New Orleans, but he was working in Baton Rouge, and he was covering Baton Rouge, the state capital. He was just good. He was just really good.
He was
good.
Great.
Had great insight. Had great wit. And he was just a really good person.
Just a depth of knowledge, too.
Yeah,
he really knew what was going on there. He knew all the players. He knew all of the backroom stories. He was great. He was absolutely wonderful.
One of his favorite lines, he'd use this like at the end of a session, and he said, you know, the legislature could have done less, but they ran out of time. And he was really good. And unfortunately, he ran out of time, too.
Way too soon.
And I'm really just proud of what we have. We should mention, talk about your career, that before you were Channel 12, I mean, you started off, you were a news anchor at Channel 6.
I was at WDSU, and I started there in the early, let's see now, so in the early 70s, I was a student at University of New Orleans, so I graduated from there, but I was still a student in political science, and one of my advisor, Mike Adley, yes, Dr. Charlie Hadley, had Ed Plainer as a guest speaker, who was at that time the news director of WDSU, and then he went on to NBC and great things. And so Charlie, I had told Charlie I was interested perhaps in journalism or broadcast journalism. It was around the time of Watergate, and there really weren't many women in broadcast journalism at that point. So Charlie said, hey, you know, this student is interested in getting into broadcast journalism. And Ed Plainer said, well, come on down to the WDSU newsroom. Well, I was there within the next day or two, and I didn't go away until they hired me. Then I became an associate producer, a producer, and a news reporter, and then ultimately an anchor. So I was there for about 10 years.
And you were doing like, what, 6 and 10?
I was doing noon and 5 with Warren Bell.
Okay.
He and I co-anchored together. And then, of course, like I said, doing reporting. I did reporting for most of my years there. Yeah. Okay.
But didn't you do evening too? With it?
No, okay. I did the 5.
Okay.
I didn't do the 6 and the 10. Okay. No. That's not as anchor. I mean, I have
that's a prestigious job. I mean, to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And Channel 6 was the first TV station in New Orleans. So there's a whole generation that knew nothing but Channel 6 in terms of watching the news. And they, the Stern family owned it. And they,
In the 70s, though, WWL quickly moved into that.
Yeah. Well, it started to change when WWL went
with
the competition.
Channel 4,
because.
Yeah.
But it was,
and Garland and Angela, they were really they were tough to compete against. But when I did start at the newsroom at WDSU, there were still some of the great journalists who had pioneered broadcast journalism there, and certainly the photographers. Some of the photographers, MJ Goche comes to mind, Mike Lala, Jim Baumgartner, Floyd Agnelli. I mean, these guys really taught me a lot about journalism, about production. Reggie Hendry and Dave Landry, who were on the floor managers, they were my first teachers. I really learned from some terrific masters, and they were pioneers in the whole field, and I really feel blessed with that. Also, I was able to stay here in New Orleans, which is my hometown. Oftentimes, certainly back then, and maybe to this day, I don't know, maybe not quite so much, but you really did have to work in small markets, then work yourself up to the bigger market, not to mention your hometown. And at that time, New Orleans was a much bigger market than it is right now, television market. So I was fortunate to do that. And then when I left DSU, I went over to WYS, started working as a producer, and then got married, starting having kids. That's when I started my freelance career, and that's when I did the documentary Survival and Celebration, and then was asked to begin Informed Sources. So to see now Informed Sources celebrate to mark its 40th year with a steady audience, and you know we're getting some folks who are younger than us, Errol, and there are a lot of those these days. I'm getting those people come up to me too, saying, "Hey, you know, I really am watching, you know, enjoying watching Informed Sources. We look for it every Friday evening." And then more and more people are also saying, "Well, you know, we DVR it, or if they can't catch it on their television, of course they can stream it, go to YouTube, because, you know, it's archived on the WYS website and then WYS YouTube as well. So there are always all kinds of ways to access it. And people from out of the New Orleans area follow us as well. I mean, we have stories of that, who people who live like in Houston, Atlanta, or whatever, you know, former New Orleanians who still want to keep in touch with what's going on in their hometown, they watch Informed Sources. They're able to access us on the web.
We're the only show that gives that type of analysis to local news. I mean, with all the cable talk channels and all that, I mean, there's lots of coverage of Hunter Biden and all that, but in terms of talking about local news,
right.
I mean...
And local news is so important. And local news has really met its challenges, and certainly local newspapers. Our market here, our population, they've demonstrated that they want their local news, and they want to know what's happening at their local level, their regional level, their state level, which is really so important. And that certainly is one reason why Informed Sources has stayed on the air for all these years, is because there is an interest in our community to find out more. Mm-hmm. And that is certainly something, too, the comments that I get is we're learning so much more about these stories, because that was the intent from the beginning, is to give the reporter more time to talk about the stories. Reporters are given only so much space in print and then so much time in broadcast or digital. And the reporter on informed sources is able really to get more deeply into the story.
Yeah, they have more, their faces on camera more right. than the I've had people who work like, you know, with the big station, you know, with the profit stations, and tell me that they get more recognition for being on informed right. sources because they just have more, more of a presence.
Right, they have more, certainly more face time than they generally yeah. do in, you know, a minute 30 or 2 minute yeah. report, but also their personality comes through, yeah. and not to mention their knowledge of the issue. And that's what informed sources was always meant to be, that kind of platform for the reporters, but also that kind of informational, you know, outlet for the viewer.
I remember one show, we've always been Friday nights, but I remember that night the show went on, there was a lot of good news, okay? Donald Trump's organization had just announced that week that they were going to build an office building in New Orleans. And then there was something else that happened. Something else big was being announced. And then the Saints season was going to start and all of that. And I remember after the show, we're kind of standing around. And this is during the time when you weren't here, mm-hmm. when you were away. But I remember after the show, kind of sitting around and we're talking. It's like, you know, that's a lot of good news tonight. And somebody says, yeah, but I'm not sure about that tropical depression out in the Gulf, okay? That was the Friday night when the turn was made for what was heading to Florida when they announced that it was heading to New Orleans. And that would have been in August, and the show wasn't again until January. And I remember when they came back, it was January 6th, it was 12th night. They came back, yeah. And so that was...
Well, you know, at that time we didn't have a chance to have the opportunity to put it online as we do now, and we found ourselves streaming it and we're taping it, you know, and we were streaming it. It's been streamed, but what I'm trying to get to is the pandemic, what we wound up doing with the pandemic. We could not go to the studio for the pandemic. You know, obviously everything was shut down. And so we were wondering, what are we going to do? If informed sources was meant for anything, it's for a time like this, to inform our community about what is happening, you know, in so many different aspects regarding this pandemic. So what we wound up doing was doing via Zoom. And everybody was in their respective locations. Our technical VP, George Matulik, just, you know, he choreographed it and coordinated it all so that we would have everybody ultimately on one screen. We taped that, and then we were able to broadcast it as well as stream it. So we were able to continue informed sources that way.
Thank goodness for Zoom. I mean, that really saved everything. I mean, right. the Cosmos did something that technology came into existence in time for dealing with Katrina and the fallout and all that, and then also with COVID. Yeah, it made a huge difference.
We were able to stay in touch with one another.
Yeah,
unlike like you said with Katrina, you guys went dark for almost 6 months, 5 months.
Yeah.
Which is a time also when having that information, everything that was happening, you know, right after Katrina, it would have been invaluable to have that informed sources type of information at that point. But the technology just really didn't, you know, exist at that time to do that.
Yeah, just for everybody to see each other. Well, let's just mention a couple of stories. On the anniversary show, we picked like five different stories. Mm-hmm. And they were the World's Fair and the economy, the Duke Edwards election, the Saints Super Bowl, and one other thing I'm trying to remember. But anyway, and we talked about those, and we can mention those, but we can talk about anything else. But the first big story, though, was the World Fair.
Mm-hmm.
That when the show was beginning, the World Fair was the issue. Things weren't going that well. There was a lot of criticism about it. And so most of the stories were kind of like a hardball look at the thing seems to be in trouble.
Certainly for informed sources, that was its first focus, was the World's Fair. That was hadn't opened up yet. It was, you know, going to right after the show debuted. But the stories leading up to it were, you know, the financial stories. Was it even going to be ready? Who was going to come? And, you know, what was going to happen with the World's Fair? Well, certainly we loved it here. You know, we had a good time with it. We didn't, you know, get as many visitors to it as we had hoped. But I think one thing that we discussed on our anniversary show on WYS was how it opened up the riverfront to, you know, to the public. It was at a time when there was really a focus on doing that, and the port, you know, the whole business of the port was shifting a bit because of the cargo containers. So just the actual way that, you know, that shipping was happening and the port activity was happening was changing, allowing the river to be opened up, taking out those wharf sheds and creating access. And the World's Fair really helped introduce that whole notion to the people of New Orleans, because we grew up, you know, walled away from the river. The river's there for us to enjoy, and the World's Fair really taught us how we could enjoy it, and we wanted to keep enjoying it.
Yeah, containerization was changing urban waterfronts, mm-hmm. really around the world. You know, the thing, we don't have to be like downtown. We can go upriver or downriver for containerization, all this. So it opened up the possibility to do more. The difference was that New Orleans had more of it to do things with, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, we had this great, beautiful waterfront and this beautiful curve in the river where you see these ships kind of gliding around. Right. And it's an historic spot. So I don't know if any place, if any town that was looking at, well, let's, you know, change our waterfront head as much as New Orleans had to offer. And the World's Fair did spur that on. It was slow, and even as we're talking about it today, there's still things going on that are follow up to all that. You know, land swaps and things as part of a bigger deal and building something else. And so the progress that was touched off by the World's Fair is still going on, and it's a great waterfront.
So then we moved along, you know, and once again going back to our anniversary show, we sort of moved it along through the decades, and we had Norman Robinson on talking about politics in that era, particularly the Duke Edwards race. And then, you know, beyond Duke Edwards, of course, Edwards won that race. It was, you know, such a charged race and brought in such national attention. And Edwards did win. And then we went on, you know, in the next decade or so, I guess, to have our first woman governor. First and only woman governor, with Kathleen Blanco, who was governor during Katrina. And we really didn't touch on that during the discussion of our 40th anniversary on the show in WYS.
Well, Blanco, in fairness to her, and she, by all accounts, was a good woman, okay, a good-hearted woman and all this, but she got smashed by Katrina.
She did.
Right. She got one term. The White House and, you know, in Washington, which was Republican, really kind of just was very tight on that. There was all kind of issues. So she really had a hard time. I think she tried. And then they did some right things, but it was a tough period. And had it not been for Katrina, she could have probably been a two-term governor. And we've talking about all she did for education. But it was really just a hurtful time for her. But, you know, the Duke Edwards thing, the implication of it is because here you had a candidate who was like a past grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan running against Edwin Edwards, who was like everything else, okay? But this was being seen globally as an indication of, is America turning to the far right, okay? It was an indication, was there a shift in the United States going on? And if Duke would have won that, that would have been what the world would have been saying, okay? You know, there's something big going on, and so
absolutely,
and so I think it was a lot of relief globally too, the way it came on.
Right. Remember the bumper sticker, "Vote for the crook." Well, it's important.
Vote for the crook. It's important. Yeah. Let me say, if I can, just a quick story. At the time, the station that had been a rock and roll station, WTIX 69, had been sold. It was a business station, located on Veterans Highway, and now it's kind of like the politics guy. I went in. I wasn't full time, but I go in. I do like a political report. Anyway, we arranged that election. I just said 1991 that we were going to do election coverage, just like the big guys. And so I was the one that put it together. And so we're in the studio, and we got reporters at each of the Duke campaign and the Edwards campaign. We ordered sandwiches and soft drinks. We cleared time, and we came at 8. We cleared time till midnight with the understanding that if the count was still going on, we'd go as long as we wanted. And they also were affiliated with a business network. So around 7:30, they called me to do a report. Well, how are things going on in Louisiana? Well, you know, the polls are closed, and, you know. And I remember the guy's closing words says, well, we'll be checking with you throughout the night. I said, okay. So 8 o'clock, we're about ready to go on. But first of all, they got the CBS News. They come on to CBS News. First thing CBS says is Edwin Edwards has won in Louisiana with 61% of the vote. They've done exit polling, okay, all right? And they had the exact figure right, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they went on saying, and NBC and ABC are also reporting the same thing. So by 3 minutes after 8, okay?
Like, so there goes the suspense, huh?
Yeah, the networks are all reporting the exact thing, okay? And like by 10 minutes after 8, nobody was interested anymore. And here we were with sandwiches and soft drinks and people, you know, geared up for the whole night. And it just died out. And that network never did call back. You know, really? The one that said, you know, we'll check with you throughout the night. So it was a dead story by the half hour.
Yeah, in terms of the, like I said, the suspense, but the outcome was extremely important for the state of Louisiana. So Edwards won. Then that was his third term, right? When he won his third term.
Yeah.
And then Romer won, right?
Right.
And then Edwards came back,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Yeah. And then after Edwards was Kathleen, was Blanco? There wasn't anybody in between that, was there?
That was Blanco. That was the emergence of Bobby Jindal, mm-hmm, in that race. And Jindal was like a rock star. He was really, really hot, okay? But Blanco won that race. That was Jindal's first setback, but he came back 4 years later and was elected to two terms.
Well, he had been the state... But health secretary under Mike Foster, right?
Yeah,
Mike Foster called him the boy wonder.
At 24 years old.
Yeah, he was so young.
Yeah, and so Mike Foster put him in health, and that got him a national attention. Here's this guy, an Indian-American.
Right.
Okay, Indian as in India, all right, 24 years old. So this is a new face in American politics, and obviously going to be a talk about a man of the future, which, of course, didn't happen. But that launched him, and then he went on and ran for Congress. And won that, and then he was ready for governor. Mm-hmm. And when he ran, I mean, he did well against Blanco, but lost. But then he came back and came on strong, but didn't end well at all. Okay, I mean, people today, when they look back at his governorship, I mean, will say like Newell Norman of WBL right off the bat said, "This is the worst governor in Louisiana history." Right, he was a rising star for a while.
Through all the 40 years of informed sources, as you said, there's been a lot of talk of politics and elections, and we try to cover it as thoroughly as possible, from the big major elections, by major I mean like statewide elections, even reflecting on presidential elections, to the smallest elections, to smallest once again, just maybe more smaller in the focus, like to a certain local type of election. But, you know, Informed Sources definitely has kept that up, and you make sure that we keep that up, too, because you have such a focus on elections and on politics, a background in politics, which has contributed a lot to the show. How long have you been producing the show?
Well, if the show's 40 years, I don't know, I guess about...
I left in 85, and I left as producer, so I guess you stepped in pretty soon after that.
I was producer, and then they had some staff people who did it for a while, but I don't know.
Well, the show really has been shepherded along for most of these decades by Errol. You've put your heart and soul into it, and you've kept it going and going strong.
Yeah. There have been some tough times, okay? but most times when I've been grateful and grateful... for the response. I just want to mention, I think I've told you the story before, that I always wondered, because an overriding story of life in New Orleans has always been the Saints. And I always wondered, if the Saints would ever get in the Super Bowl, what would we do that Friday night? Because the game's on a Sunday. So that Friday night, we give the whole show to the Saints? Because that's an enormous story. Or would we just try to just mention them and do it? Okay. Well, I kind of decided, just privately, Saints got a Super Bowl. We'll get to the whole show for the Saints, okay? I think we had Jim Henderson, who was the sports announcer, okay? Well, it turns out that Friday night was the night before the mayoral election,
right?
The one in which Mitch Landrieu got elected. Well, he couldn't ignore a mayoral election when a new incumbent. So as it turns out, I mean, we did maybe two-thirds of the show in the mayoral election. We did sneak the Saints in, but that was just a big night. I mean, that was just a lot. a lot and I'll play them one night.
You know, certainly in thinking about these past 40 years, you know, and I wasn't involved with the show for many of those. You know, I've been back now as the host for 10 years. But for the most part, they're really... Maybe some weeks might be a little thin, it would seem, about the topics we could cover. But generally, there's really never been a shortage of issues and topics to cover for informed sources. I mean, this is just such a big news market. There's always so much going on. We have an interested citizenry, a very active citizenry also, about their culture, about their economy, certainly about their politics. And there's just so much that happens in this region that can be covered and discussed in a show like Informed Sources.
Yeah, well, especially the politics. I mean, the politics never ends. Yeah, and even when there's not an election, there's the legislature, and the legislature right. goes on and on and on. And so there's a lot of that. Sometimes a holiday week, all right, like the week after holiday, that's kind of slow because everybody's still on vacation.
Right.
But usually the legislature's in session, so we do that. But no, there's always and unfortunately, crime is always there.
Yeah.
Okay. It's always there, and there's always a new angle and a new analysis. So there is just in this past year with a new police chief, a new perspective on the police crime, the consent decree, and so there's a lot of that behind the more than just a scene of the crime things.
Is Orleans Parish, and as I mentioned, you know, we've become a bigger region. Certainly since Katrina, where we've seen some population shifts. And, you know, the parishes, the neighboring parishes to Orleans, those in the metro area, do generate news, too. Some parishes more than others. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we have covered and will continue to cover from Jefferson Parish. But St. Tammany has really been a parish where there's been a lot of news coming out, a lot of it on the political end.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of investigations going on in St. Tammany. You know, people think that usually all the bad stuff goes on in the city, okay? But there have been some incredible things going on. But meanwhile, St. Tammany has just sprouted. I mean, it's just one of the largest parishes in the state, and Jefferson Parish, and so they're really just populous and prosperous parishes.
And, you know, another thing, and you mentioned this before about business stories, but the economy of the region is something that we're focused on a lot. And while some things sort of remain steady with the economy, certainly the port, still very, very important, but we've watched tourism really grow in this area. We've seen the movie industry move in, the tech industry really trying to grow more than it has. It really, you know, wants to make a real mark here in New Orleans as being a tech center.
The oil economy took a dip. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, and that was at the same time when Houston was just getting really big and prosperous, and so that was a bad period as far as the oil industry. Luckily, an emerging tourism industry kind of came in and helped a little.
And move that along, and certainly now what we're facing, and it is a real big challenge to us, is what's happening to our coast, and you know not only how it's impacting our culture and communities along the coast, but communities like New Orleans, also in the metro region, in terms of our safety. You know, we're concerned about storms. This is supposed to be, unfortunately, a busy season. But also how it's hitting us in the pocketbook. We're seeing this with insurance. You know, that's a real big issue facing the folks here in this area, in southeast Louisiana, southwest Louisiana, too, along the coast, maybe all of Louisiana. So these are all things that we will certainly be looking into and covering even more because they're major
issues. Well, the coast, to your credit, has been a real expertise of yours that you spend a lot of time studying the coast. And so I kind of look at you as kind of like a leader on the coastal issues. On that,
Mark Schlechtstein is really, you know, the go-to guy.
Yeah.
Because he definitely knows what's going on about the coast. He really does. But it's an issue that WIS wants to continue to explore and just – make the public, just give the public the information that they need to know so that they can make informed decisions as it relates to what's going on with our coastal crisis and the environment.
Any two or three people that stand out in your mind, good or bad, during this period?
You're talking about reporters or just
people
newsmakers?
Out there, yeah, people out there, yeah.
I think that, you know, on the show you said Tom Benson. Well, yeah, I mean, that was a really great pick. I mean, think of the impact that Tom Benson has made on this community.
Oh, absolutely.
And Gail Benson now, too, following and just carrying that along. Tremendous impact to this community. Ron Foreman was mentioned, and certainly I agree with that. Dutch Morial, yeah, absolutely. I think the Landrieu family also has contributed so much to this community. But somebody that really is in, you know, sort of the forefront of my mind, because I worked closely with him on a project recently, is Nick Mueller. And then, of course, that means Stephen Ambrose, too. Nick Mueller and Stephen Ambrose, two UNO history professors, came up with the idea of having a museum that remembers the sacrifices of World War II. And now look what we have, the National World War II Museum, a world-class museum, a real tourist draw, something that locals go to. It's an educational resource just about, you know, World War II, just unparalleled. So Nick Mueller and Stephen Ambrose, the late Stephen Ambrose, they definitely made a big impact on this community over the last 20 years or so, 25, 30 years.
And I know they both had a huge admiration for each other. But remember the story about the internal debate at the beginning where Ambrose thought it should be on the lakefront because that's right. Where the Higgins boats and other people prevailed and said, no, you got to put it downtown where the tourists are going to be. I don't think anybody – it turns out the main building was the Higgins building for the warehouse too. So it still had that Higgins touch to it. But I don't think anybody doubts that decision.
No, not at all. And, you know, when Nick and Steve first started talking about the idea, Steve brought it up to Nick. They were just complete buds. They, you know, were just really best of friends and always sharing ideas and always, you know, coming up with some kind of scheme to do something. And so, you know, Stephen said, hey, look, Nick, you're going to do this. I have all of these. Stephen had collected oral histories from D-Day veterans, first off, and then, you know, to all World War II veterans. You know, not that he got them all, but he went beyond just D-Day. He had all of these oral histories, and he wanted them to live somewhere. And so that's how he came up with the idea to have a small museum there on the lakefront. And he first told Nick, oh, it's just cost $1 million. Mm-hmm. Well, a little bit more than that, you know. And Nick said, oh, no, Steve, you know, it's not going to just be $1 million. You're just so naive there. It's going to cost at least $4 million. A little bit more than that, too, like closer to $500 million is what's gone into that whole complex now. But look what it's given us.
Yeah, more than just a building, Ambrose's legacy is his books, the things he's written.
Yeah.
They're such important books on the history of World War II. And if someone who reads those books, mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably things like Band of Brothers is probably the most important now. I mean, I guess maybe one day something will supersede it. You know, for a long time, it was this book, The Longest Day, was mm-hmm. the go-to book, but Band of Brothers and... And it's read all over Europe, too. I mean, it's really really an important book. And yeah, recently a former UNO professor, I was talking to a political science professor, was talking about Ambrose, and he said kind of what you said, that the really important thing in legacy is all those oral interviews, because nobody else did that.
Right.
Nobody else who was covering the history of the war had that.
And there are, you know, I should know this, I can't remember how many thousands now offhand of oral histories there at the museum that researchers or anyone can access. There are some that, you know, there are oral history booths that you can go to and listen to these vets tell their stories personally. And now I haven't seen this yet, but apparently there's an interactive Q&A that they've set up recently too. I think mostly with people who in some way were active, maybe they worked in a manufacturing facility or something.
Like
I don't know if they're real veterans of that interactive.
The hologram technology.
I don't think they're using the hologram now yet, but they're there are hopes to. But right now they're doing the interactive with the individual so they can talk about what they did during World War II. Mm-hmm. the museum just, you know, it has so much. And, it, you know, one area that it focuses on is reminding people of what went on in the home front during World War II and how just folks at home contributed, including children, and collecting scrap and everything. It once again, it's just really such an incredible thing that Nick and Steve, because of their idea and their stick-to-itiveness, because this was not an easy thing to pull off, but they did it and worked for a solid decade in making it happen. And it, of course, it opened as the National D-Day Museum at first, but they made it happen, and look what they gave. So in terms of, there was a long answer to your question, but in terms of people who stood out, certainly Nick and Steve.
Yeah. And, you know, and there wouldn't have been a Steve Ambrose in New Orleans or a Nick Mueller or World War II Museum if they hadn't been the University of New Orleans.
That's correct.
And it was crazy old Earl Long, okay, you know, they got that bill, you know.
That's right. It was at LSUNO at that time.
Earl Long had probably never been into a college library in his life, okay, but not a library at UNO.
Is the Earl K. Long Library, right.
And there's one more other governor we got to put in the conversation. That's Edwin Edwards.
Sure.
All right. He's remembered for his humor, and he was just great at it. He accomplished a lot, too, and he built a lot of things.
Right, there's the Superdome.
Yeah, the Superdome and the arena.
Mm-hmm. And the arena, absolutely.
Actually, the World's Fair, I remember talking to a woman, and you know, the World's Fair was bogged down. She said, I'm not worried because Edwards was running for re-election. She says, Edwards is going to win re-election, and you'll get it taken care of. Okay. And he rewrote the Constitution. I mean, they're trying to rewrite it again, but the president of the Constitution was stalled for a long time, and you know, he got mm-hmm. that done. Had it not been for his walking the tight line, he could have been a national political player.
Yeah, he was just so smart, and like you said, so witty, and such a gifted politician. He was really quite the guy, Edwin.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Let's see. Think about this.
Well, there's lots of them, and
there are so many. You know, Moon Landrieu, and then you know so many of his kids have gone into public life. You know, Mary Landrieu, former U.S. senator, and then of course Mitch Landrieu, a former mayor, who's now one of the leaders of the Biden campaign, and his name certainly has come up also for potential presidential candidate down the line, if not sooner. But, you know, the Landrieu family really has made such a tremendous impact on this community, as well as the Morial family, because, of course, it was Dutch at first, and then his son Mark was our mayor, and other members of the family also really contribute so much to this community. Sybil Morial, I mean, what a leader she's been, too. Who else could we... Yeah, I know we're missing just
really
so many people. It's
usually a bonding moment with Dutch Morial, who could be mean sometimes. He could be really angry, but he could also be kind of a very rarely, but a friendly man. But anyway, early in his administration was the Mardi Gras police strike, and he's the first black mayor, and he had the high potential of being a black white thing. All right, that the mayor is against the police, and the police are mostly white, okay? And the public was mostly white, but the mayor was black. I mean, it had all those kind of things going on. And it was personally painful for him because he'd made his career as a union lawyer, and so his kind of heart was with it. But in the end, they all stood together, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That the white community stood behind Morial, especially when the crews all said, you know, we're not going to, you know, given the Teamsters Union, and it was a good moment for the city, right? And I can tell you, as someone who watches Mardi Gras, the rest of his time, he was one of the best mayors Mardi Gras had. I mean, he really went out and did things, and so I always appreciate him. I mean, he was a smart mayor, and a lot was accomplished during his time.
You know who else comes to mind, Errol, is Dorothy May Taylor. Dorothy May Taylor had a real impact on the community, and certainly in terms of Carnival.
Well, she did. And also, she would have been the first black woman council member at large, too. So, anyway. So yeah, all that played out, and you know, along with well. Before we go, I might have told you this. If I did, forgive me for repeating it. But when we talk about Nick Mueller, this is a story. We had Nick Mueller actually on this podcast one time, and a story he told, right, about Ambrose, right? And he said that when Band of Brothers was being filmed, they were at the final stages, and Steven Spielberg calls Ambrose one time and says, Steve, we're almost finished. We'd like for you to see the rough cut because there's any major problems. So if you come, you know, let us bring it to Los Angeles and we'll have a private screening. Now,
for this is Saving Private Ryan you're talking about, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Saving Private Ryan, okay. And he said, we'll send you the, you know, bring it to Los Angeles. Now, if you just wrote a book, and the book was being made into a movie by Steven Spielberg, and Steven Spielberg said, let me bring it to Los Angeles to see this, wouldn't you say yes? Okay. And we said, nah, I don't have time. I'm working on other books. I just can't do it. I can't get away. He says, what? I just can't do it. And he said, okay, we'll bring the film to New Orleans. And they arranged. I don't know if it was actually a film canister, what the technology was, whatever thing that films were in those days. They flew it to New Orleans with security guards because there's a lot of industrial sabotage that goes on. So they had it with security guards. They rented one of the screens at the West Bank Cinema, whichever cinema it is. Okay, they had a private screening. They had Ambrose, and I think just him, maybe one of his people. Then they had security guards around there. And then they show the film, and they start, and Ambrose is just sitting there. And they're a few minutes into it, and all of a sudden Ambrose says, oh, stop, wait, stop this. Got to stop. Oh, God, what's going wrong? He says, I got to take a smoke. Okay. So he interrupted it, and he went outside, had a cigarette, and then came back in, watched it, and then it turns out he loved it. Okay, he was really pleased. But once he started saying stop, stop at the very beginning,
they were worried, huh?
They thought they were in trouble. So
yeah, well, he traveled around with Spielberg and the cast to promote it, promote that film, which you know I did a documentary about the origins of the museum, and I you know interviewed Nick extensively, and he's really featured throughout the documentary, and also had some archive. Fortunately, able to get some archive interviews of Dr. Ambrose. The documentary is called Founded on Friendship and Freedom, the National World War II Museum. You can find it on WYS YouTube or through Passport or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, Nick brought out the fact that because Stephen was going around the country promoting this film, Saving Private Ryan, it was also increasing interest and knowledge about what was going on in New Orleans in building the National D-Day Museum first. It really did help in the funding effort to get the money to actually open the doors for the D-Day Museum in 2000.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, it has been fun. We can just go on chatting because we've known each other for a long, long time now.
You know what? You still got the TV anchor in front of you, man. You still question. You're still there, you know? It could be like a...
Errol, I'm so old now. You know, it's hard to break the old dog, huh?
Yeah.
It's just really, I've enjoyed our friendship. I enjoyed the time before, you know, I was doing Informed Sources while I was, you know, raising the family. You and I would get together for lunch maybe once a year or so and just catch up, see what's going on. And so now it's been fun being back on the show with you over these past 10 years. And as I said, you know, on our anniversary show, you know, we're looking forward to another 40 plus years. It may not be you and me around the desk, but WIS is committed to Informed Sources because it means a lot to the community.
And by the way, we've mentioned the 40th anniversary show. It's on YouTube, right?
I mean, right.
Can people find it?
Yeah.
So really, I got to tell you, it's a good show.
Yeah, it is.
It's a really good show. Look for it on YouTube. It's called Informed Sources 40th Anniversary Special. Because it goes back in 40 years, you don't need to worry about it being dated or anything.
It's got some shelf life, yeah.
Yeah, and we had a good panel in there with Norman Robinson, who, by the way, talks about, he was on the TV panel, when they interviewed Duke and Edwards. And he has some pretty damn tough questions for David Duke. He talks about that. Stephanie Regal just did a masterful job with talking about the economy. Dave Cohen, the radio guy, and Dave Cohen's the ultimate radio guy, and you know, I always tell him I remember that Katrina hit here on a Monday. People evacuated it Sunday. It hit Monday, and early in the day, it looked like the worst was over. It knocked down a few trees, went to bed. We'll all be home by Wednesday. And I remember being in Marksville later that night, listening to WBL, and Dave coming on and saying, well, got some bad news. The levees have broken in New Orleans. And that was like the beginning of our lives changing dramatically.
Yeah, I can remember hearing that too, feeling my heart drop.
For a while. That was fun.
Yeah, he talks about that. He talks about Katrina as it was coming and then also post-Katrina. And certainly WWL did such an incredible job of keeping us all informed because we were all scattered around. You know, we weren't home.
And then a couple of years ago, what was the one that knocked over the power transformers? That was the...
Ida, right?
Ida, okay. Well, somewhere I'm listening. It's a Saturday night. I'm listening to Dave Cohen. And he says, the power transformers have been knocked down. I'm thinking... Damn you, Dave. I mean, it's like you always know, the guy delivers like the fatal blow. Well, it turns out it wasn't as bad as it sounded at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, it sounded like New Orleans was going to be without power for like 6 months.
I know. I think we all envisioned that again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think some of the energy officials weren't quite on top of their technology. But anyway, it was fixed quickly. But I remember twice listening to deliver this bad news. So.
Yeah. When you first heard about that tower falling into the river.
Yeah.
It, once again, my heart dropped, you know, thinking the same thing as you. Good. So, okay, on to the next 40, Errol.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.